Welcome to another episode of Film Exploration with Ash Hurry, and this is a special one. We have finally undertaken a James Bond movie after around 158 episodes or so, and I figured go for the one that I grew up with, and of course that fits perfectly with season 14 blockbusters that have been revised in some way, and Bond famously adapted from the Ian Fleming books on a British secret agent. So for today's episode, we're going to be talking about the 1995 spy action thriller GoldenEye, starring for the first time as Bond, Pierce Brosnan. And co-starring Sean Bean, Famke Janssen, Alan Cummins, Robbie Coltrane, Isabella Scorpupco, Godfrey John, Desmond Llewellyn, and Dame Judi Dench. James Bond, one of the most famous fictitious characters to ever grace our screens at best, echoes the British nonchalant arrogance, the total disregard for etiquette in terms of his relationships with women, his never straightforward missions that usually go against the path. The government expect him to follow his drinking, his smoking habits, but nonetheless, his rogue attitude, his electric charm, and his gentleman exterior provides the perfect ingredients to be a force to be reckoned with in the hands of the British Secret Service. The character created by Ian Fleming back in 1953 only featured Bond in 12 novels and 2 short stories. And yet here we are today with 25 productions of the film. I know what you're thinking, the maths doesn't really add up. But they really treasured Bond and needed to extend his mortality even after Fleming's death in 1964, just 2 years after the first movie, Dr. No. GoldenEye isn't even based on a book. The book came out after the film was released, along with the Nintendo 64 video game, its reboot of the game 10 years later, and the novel that followed the film, making GoldenEye probably one of the most adapted stories about Bond. In fact, the most adapted, I've just looked it up. Also, the third movie with gold in its title, with Goldfinger and the Man of the Golden Gun. So John Gardner was the guy who took charge of the continuation of the novels from 81 to 96, who wrote more books about Bond than Fleming did, 16 novels, 2 of which became films, License to Kill and GoldenEye, quoting that he wanted to revamp Bond into the era of the 80s while still holding on to the rustic qualities that Fleming introduced in the 50s. In the book, Bond is slightly grey but the same age, a weathered man with years of experience and knowledge on the dark world of espionage. The books were popular, but the novels were criticised by diehard fans for being too Americanised, using the words pants instead of trousers, and the Hollywood scenarios the character got himself into rather than the subtle grit James Bond delves in and out of during his missions, which strayed true to the British no-nonsense attitude, rather than the elaborate Hollywood moments that occur. And these are shown very heavily in the Pierce Brosnan era, with the insane opening scene at the start of GoldenEye. And no, I'm not talking about the world record bungee jump, which was actually performed for real, by the way, no. I'm talking about the slightly illogical but rather cool stunt of Bond free fall into a descending plane with no pilot before going in there, piloting it and going over a mountain with the opening credits going in a very Hollywood way. Very Hollywood, and the ridiculous Hollywood Brosnan era didn't stop there. We had car chase scenes on ice with lasers beaming from space. We had surfing miracles being attempted and die another day. But that fits the bill on the time Brosnan took over as Bond and the time period it fell into. Interestingly, according to the Bond tailors that worked on the film, and they worked with every single Bond, Pierce Brosnan was both the lightest and the heaviest Bond in the franchise, lightest in GoldenEye and the heaviest in Die Another Day. That's exactly what a good paycheck does to you in the movie industry. So GoldenEye is the 17th film in the series, a series that is measured as the 5th highest grossing franchise in history, introducing our 5th Bond on his first outing, with the first outing for director Martin Campbell as well, director of Vertical Limit, and coincidentally Daniel Craig's first outing in Casino Royale. So he directed 2 Bond debut films. He's also the first non-British director to direct the James Bond film to that point. Also the first film not to be produced by Albert Broccoli. This was the transition where his daughter Barbara Broccoli took over. It happened to be his final Bond film before his death after the film's release. This film follows no source material of Ian Fleming whatsoever besides the reoccurring characters from the original. This was a story conceived and written by Michael France and a handful of other writers. The film breaks a lot of interesting records that began its track record when Sean Connery donned the tuxedo in 1962 as James Bond in Dr. No. That was 16 films ago, and since then the establishment of the one-liners, the reoccurring characters like Q and Moneypenny, the vodka martinis, the Aston Martins, the Walther PPK gun, have become trademark as the franchise has gone on. And speaking of Aston Martin, this film decided to drop it. That's right, it was the first time in a Bond movie where they used a German car. And because it only, I think BMW made the, I think they made the Z3 for $3 million and it recouped the money. And it made $240 million just because of the movie. So they had to sign a free movie deal to promote BMW cars, hence why Tomorrow Never Dies and The World Is Not Enough is using BMWs, not Aston Martins. And the other trademark qualities that occur, like the quick wit that results in charming one-liners, the sexual innuendos, the famous introduction of his name, have all been a steady building block from the last 16 films shared by four actors before Brosnan. So anything, the role has a manuscript to closely study and act as a guideline. The other records the 17th movie has broken is, yes, this is the first Irish actor to play Bond, the first time Pierce Brosnan steps into the role. Like I said, Broccoli comes in as a producer, her daughter, Barbara, for the first time. Martin Campbell was director, first non-British director as well. And also the first time CGI was used to create the famous gun barrel opening, making this the first CGI film in a Bond series. And naturally, because of the time, in the first Bond movie to be released on DVD. The big ones, though, the ones that are really record-breaking, is this is the first completely original James Bond movie without referencing any Ian Fleming novel of any short story. This is the biggest gap as well between two films James Bond has to date, which is 6 years, between Timothy Dalton's License to Kill in 89 to this film, GoldenEye in 95. I think there was another six-year gap between Spectre and No Time to Die of Daniel Craig, but on a technicality, on the months, the biggest gaps are still between Dalton and Brosnan. And this is also the first time to introduce M as a woman, who is famously played by the lovely Dame Judi Dench. The other interesting thing about GoldenEye is the first one after the downfall of the Soviet Union and the end of the Civil War. So this is technically the first film to shoot in a country of Russia, more specifically St. Petersburg. But yes, this film had to change a lot, risk a lot, even the first time in the franchise to change the actors who played Moneypenny and M. They kept good old Desmond as Q until The World Is Not Enough, but it was a six-year gap. And that time period between 89 and 95, cinema had adapted, special effects were on the scene, animation, computer-generated films, which was the biggest film of the year, 1995, Toy Story. However, GoldenEye did do well that year, the sixth highest grossing film of the year worldwide, earning over $100 million worldwide, the most successful Bond film since Moonraker back in 1979. GoldenEye, a film that had nothing to do with any source material of Ian Fleming at all. In fact, the only relevance that the name GoldenEye has is it's the nickname of Ian Fleming's house in Jamaica between 52 and 64, where he wrote the Bond novels and short stories, which is why Jamaica's a big influence or big setting in Dr. No. In terms of Pierce Brosnan playing the role, the gap caused a massive problem in terms of who to cast. Should they go for someone unknown? Do they follow suit? Cast someone who is British, tall, dark hair, brown eyes, you know, fitting the bill, ticking the boxes. And exceptions can be made. I mean, George Lazenby was born in Australia. However, he lived most of his life in England. I think Roger Moore and Daniel Craig are the only ones that are actually born in England. Pierce was also an exception, not on the physicality, but on being an actor born outside of Great Britain. Timothy Dalton, by the way, was still interested in doing a third Bond movie. And a discussion to play him happened, but he was contracted to do one more, so he was definitely obliged to do it. But they thought it'd be pointless if Dalton came back for one more Bond after a six-year gap. And then they had to recast him again. So they thought, okay, let's just end it there. Let's go for someone completely new. And I agree with that. And when Dalton first played Bond in The Living Daylights, Pierce Brosnan auditioned for the role, but he didn't get it. And someone who was really upset about that was the future Home Alone and Harry Potter director Chris Columbus, who thought personally Pierce Brosnan was a fantastic actor, but better yet, a better candidate for playing James Bond. Anyways, because of this, he thought of him when he directed Mrs. Doubtfire. He casted him in that and even told him on set, you should play Bond when it comes up. And during filming of Mrs. Doubtfire, unknown to director Columbus or anyone else, the studios were scouting for the next Bond for the 1995 film GoldenEye, which they already had the script ready and they kept it under wraps. And the studio, you know, given how successful Home Alone was like, oh, by the way, Chris, who do you reckon is going to be a good Bond? Because, well, you know, we're actually looking. And he goes, well, I've actually got one in my movie right now. Why don't you take a look at Pierce Brosnan? He ticks every single box and, well, the rest is history. They looked at Sam Neill as well after the massive success of Jurassic Park. He refused the role. I think he was the only actor to actually refuse the role because he was offered it. Hugh Grant, who they didn't think could pull off convincingly the action sequences. The studio asked around. I mean, Sean Connery suggested they go for Mel Gibson. And they would have as well if he wasn't making and starring in a film that won the Oscar that year, which was Braveheart. So Pierce Brosnan was obviously the option they went for, and they announced him in 1994 at the Regent Hotel in London while he was sporting a massive beard because he was shooting a movie. Can't remember which one it was, but his character had a beard in that. So others in contention were Liam Neeson and Lambert Wilson. Sean Bean actually was considered for the role, but he got the role of the villain. 006 in an ironic fashion, a role that was originally for Anthony Hopkins but rejected, then Alan Rickman, who rejected because he didn't want to play too many villains, and then the third option accepted, which was Sean Bean. So GoldenEye was critical to the continuation of Bond, a film, a franchise, a character that was at the risk of losing itself with the old age time that stood before the revolutionary thinking of the 90s and even after that. Bond was invented to be someone who could get all the women and beat all the villains and look good doing it without the use of any superpowers, but simple wit, charm and an army background molded into slickness by the British government. With the franchise spanning generations, and with that has to come change in terms of the acceptance of this character, and is it still cool and does it serve to be problematic and outdated at times. One of the reluctance of casting M as a woman was because they didn't want a woman telling Bond what to do. But that all changed their minds when Dame Judi Dench was casted, and it was a radical but great decision considering how her character is sort of the glue for the films that followed. One of the best moments, I think, in the entire franchise, and it shows the transitional period, is in GoldenEye when M confronts Bond in the bluntest manner possible and calls him to his face a sexist, misogynistic dinosaur, a relic of a Cold War. Which by the time GoldenEye had come out was the public kind of image of James Bond, and that could have easily been that way and he could have been seen in a negative way. But, you know, when the writers turned it on its head immediately and decided to just call it out in the movie immediately, recognise this is what Bond was and perhaps still is, but there is a character within that are acknowledging these minor problematic personality traits and raising their voices. But Bond is still cool. But he's in a world now that doesn't deal with this fantasy that he, you know, he could get every woman, or he may struggle with fights, or he could fall in love with someone. And that's something the Daniel Craig era sort of tackles, the grit of being a human, not the fancy of a man that is invincible, as Boris mentions in this movie. The swagger and confidence remains and was given a high bar when Connery was the epitome of just cool, sexy back in the 60s. Lazenby maybe tried to ground Bond a little with being romantic and a little less aggressive, but that trait does somewhat remain with Brosnan, even with Craig, and yet manages to be popular, even with the questions and time we live in now, in terms of misogyny and sexism. Brosnan actually stopped the smoking, actually invited more misogynistic qualities in his role as Bond. But above all else, James Bond is an action star when Pierce Brosnan had his stint as James Bond. And this is backed up, like I said, when we have the very Hollywood action sequences that take place in his four movies. I mean, this film, GoldenEye, unfortunately, well, maybe fortunately for itself, was somehow outlived by the success of the video game of the same name, ranking 1 out of 100 as most beloved video game of all time in a poll taken just recently. So it's still relevant. It's still survived the test of time. It's a very challenging for people of my generation, or maybe millennial. Well, millennials is my people, or maybe Gen X, or even, you know, Gen Z, I don't know, of either generation, to detach GoldenEye from the film, to the, you know, detach the film from the video game. And the video game just came out 15 months after the film, so there was a bit of a gap. But if you remove the existence of the game, the film still holds firm. It was a franchise peak, in my opinion, and people were gagging for the return of James Bond after a six-year hiatus. GoldenEye exercises its intensity in becoming a Bond film, with having arguably the best-looking Bond to date. It smoothly offers the trademark iconic pre-credit sequences in a majestic fashion, being completely bonkers, which just shows the director the direction and energy this film, Pierce Brosnan period, is going to function in. And for the mid-90s, this was stimulating. It was on train. It was explosive. Within the film, literally being born minutes ago, you have two death-defying stunts, one done for real that landed itself in the Guinness Book of Records, one just illogically Hollywood but completely striking to the audience's naked, sort of naive eyes, the depth and beauty of Tina Turner's voice tempting us into the rest of the movie. And then the film never really went downhill after that, when it could have easily done so and still would have been a decent movie because of how high the opening 5-10 minutes were. GoldenEye ticked every box that was established in the last 16 productions, and it did it with style and flair relevant to the mid-90s identity crisis of action movies. It gave us steel-stealing performances by a Bond girl, memorable action sequences, corny one-liners, and Pierce Brosnan enters a debut role like he has done the role 5 times before. Besides the film's shameless attempt of ever-expanding product placement like the Omega Seamaster, the film, dare I say, is bulletproof. And where its strength lies is the strength of what makes every movie tick, every Bond movie tick. Yes, you do need to get the cast and the Bond right, but with good comes bad. And the one thing that makes each Bond film great is the lavishness of the villain. And Sean Bean, now given this somewhat misguided reputation of dying in every movie, has the number one contender of that list in this movie. I mean, one of the best death sequences ever. And I say misguided reputation. He doesn't die in every movie. I think I saw him in Troy the other day, and he... it survives the entire movie. Not only that, he has the greatest plan in that movie. Good old Odysseus. Anyway, not only does he play tricks with the audiences in GoldenEye with his allegiance to Bond, but, you know, being British, an actual contender to play Bond himself, and giving him the trademark physical qualities and defects that most Bond villains seem to have. I mean, his death scene is nothing short of what is anticipated and more. I mean, Connery ensured Goldfinger gets sucked out of an airplane. Roger Moore made sure Hugo Drax dies in space. And in GoldenEye, we just have some good old-fashioned height and weight. If fall into your death wasn't enough, you needed a satellite the size of a football stadium to land onto you, sharp end first, whilst Brosnan hangs on confidently on a helicopter and flies away, ready to battle the next three movies in the same swagger he introduced in his debut film, one of my favourites, GoldenEye. Anyway, that's all I have time for with GoldenEye. Don't forget Quantum Recast, the other podcast I sometimes co-host, took this film back to 1994, one whole year, and recasted it with different actors. That's an episode worth checking. We obviously didn't cast any of the original actors, otherwise then that'd be a completely pointless episode. But check that episode out. Quantum Recast are cool. They're on social media, Instagram, as am I. And if you can follow me as well, that'd be amazing. Film Exploration, AH, all lowercase, all one word. But for now, thank you for tuning in to another episode of Film Exploration with Ash Curry. Down.